You're listening to the Biographics Podcast. This is an episode that originally aired on YouTube, so there used to be a visual element. There is not anymore. This is just for your listening pleasure. Maybe you're out walking the dog or driving the car where it's not so easy to watch the video version. This is why this audio version exists. If you like us doing this, please do leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. We really do appreciate it, and let's get into this episode.
His image has become iconic. The thin, bearded, ascetic religious leader who had turned a once Western-friendly country into a theocratic regime and a rogue state. I am, of course, talking about Ayatollah Ruhollah Mustafavi Khomeini, the supreme leader of the Iranian Revolution. From Tehran, he would incite Iranians and Muslims around the world to oppose the great Satan, America. And America reciprocated this favor by imposing draconian sanctions on Iran and by isolating the country. Pop culture also played its part by elevating Khomeini and the Iranians to the status of top world bad guys, in second place only after the Soviets. Now, if you grew up in the 1980s, you're probably familiar with the faceless pilots taken down by Tom Maverick Cruise in the movie Top Gun. They fly MiG fighter jets, but they're not Soviets, so they have to be Iranians. Or maybe you have watched and re-watched the epic intro sequence Naked Gun, where Leslie Nielsen beats the crap out of a group of anti-American leaders, including an Ayatollah sporting a mohawk under his turban. Or if you are a hopeless geek, you surely remember that Batman issue when Khomeini hired the Joker as Iranian ambassador to the UN so that he could kill the whole General Assembly with poison gas. But reality is not directed by Tony Scott, may he rest in peace, nor scripted by DC Comics. This is why today we're going to look at the complex experiences that shaped Khomeini into becoming a leading cleric who went on to oppose the Emperor of Iran and become a revolutionary at the age of 79. We will also learn how his relationship with Satan, America, in this situation was more ambiguous than both parties wanted us to believe. The man who would become known as Ayatollah Khomeini was born Ruhollah Mustafavi Mousavi, the youngest of six siblings. His date of birth is disputed, but we're going to settle for this video on the 24th of September 1902, and his place of birth was Khomein, a town in what was then the Kingdom of Persia, which later became Iran. Like the majority of the population in Iran, he was born into a family of the Shia Muslim faith, a family who claimed to be descended from the Prophet Muhammad. Ruhollah's father, Sayyid Mustafa al-Shahid al-Khomeini, was a high-ranking cleric bearing the title of Hayat al-Islam. And let's make a quick stop here for one, pronunciations, bit difficult in this one, please give me a break. And the second clarification, we need to say who the Shias are and what the difference is between them and the majority Muslim sect, the Sunnis. These two factions share many spiritual and religious practices, as their schism was political in nature. After the death of Muhammad in 632, his advisor Abu Bakr became the first caliph or successor to the Prophet, tasked with leading the Islamic nation. But his leadership was challenged by the followers of Ali, the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law. This latter faction originated the Shia sect, who believed that the leadership of the Islamic nation belongs to the direct descendants of the Prophet. On the other hand, Sunni Muslims believe that the leadership of the community is not a birthright. It can and it must be earned. And now let's look at religious titles. A mullah indicates a religious leader or a teacher in a madrasa or religious school. The honorific title of Hujjat al-Islam or Proof of Islam is given only to high-ranking scholars who, once progressed to the next level, are addressed as Ayatollahs. And with that out of the way, let's get back to our story. When Ruhollah was very small, his father died. According to some sources, he was still an infant, but according to CIA declassified documents, he was 5 years old. We also know for sure that Ruhollah's father was assassinated, but sources differ on how. Maybe the killer was a bandit, but the CIA source claims that he was killed by a local governor for taking part in the so-called Persian Constitutional Revolution of 1906. Aged 16, Ruhollah had to experience another trauma when his mother also died. The oldest of the siblings, his brother Mortaza, then took charge of him and made sure that Ruhollah continued the family tradition by studying in various Islamic schools. At 19, Ruhollah traveled to Iraq, where he studied religion under Ayatollah Abd al-Karim Ha'iri, a well-known Islamic scholar. In 1922, Ruhollah followed Ha'iri to the Feyze Madrasa in Qom, Iran's intellectual center for Islamic studies. Here, Ruhollah distinguished himself in a variety of studies which would shape his political career, including ethics, philosophy, and law, all subjects that he would go on to teach. In 1932, Ruhollah married the daughter of a prominent cleric from the capital, Tehran, a marriage which gave him 7 children, 2 of which unfortunately died in infancy. In 1937, his old master, Ayatollah Ha'iri, died. He continued to grow his reputation as a learned scholar by becoming the assistant to another leading Ayatollah, Hussein Borajerdi. It was around this period that he started to become known as Ruhollah Khomeini. Khomeini's residence in Qom was mostly dedicated to teaching and studying, but it may have been at this stage that he started to develop a political concern. The mid-1930s were, in fact, the years in which the Shah and Shahd, the King of Kings, Reza Pahlavi, launched a series of reforms which could have undermined the authority of the Shia clergy. These were things like opening the first university or emancipating women by demanding for their chadors or veils to be discarded. In 1944, Khomeini co-authored a book condemning the Shah, who by then had abdicated in favor of his son, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. But beyond that, we don't have any other anti-government activities on Khomeini's record. The only thing we know for certain is that throughout the 1940s and 1950s, Khomeini continued to teach in Qom, becoming a nationally renowned authority in Islamic jurisprudence. It wasn't until 1962 that Khomeini would raise his voice and to become a scourge for the rule of the Shah. The Shah and Shah, or more simply just the Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, rose to power in 1941. His father, Reza, just Reza without the Mohammed, had abdicated following a preemptive occupation of Iran by the UK and the USSR, who wanted to prevent a German invasion. In August of 1953, the Shah was forced to flee by the supporters of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. Mossadegh had successfully nationalized oil production, which until now had been controlled by British companies. This, of course, did not make Britain happy, who sought assistance from the US to remove Mossadegh from power and reinstate the Shah. Formally, Pahlavi maintains the nationalization of oil production, but behind the scenes he shared the profits with a US-led international consortium. This is when the Shah became the strongest ally of the US in the Middle East and Central Asia. With the assistance of Washington, the Shah launched a White Revolution, a reform program aimed at developing the country's infrastructure. Most of all, this was a program of modernization and westernization, which continued some of the work already started by Reza Sr. But nobody liked these reforms. Left-wing factions wanted more, they were wary of the Shah's dependence on the US, and were angered by the unequal distribution of oil revenues. The religious conservative side criticized the reforms for being too radical. You really can't make everybody happy. But what brought everybody together in really hating the Shah was the corruption in his government, and his reliance on autocratic rule, and the power of the Savak, the feared secret police. As dissent escalated, so did the activities of the sinister organization, originally established, trained, and funded with CIA support, as confirmed by a Senate Foreign Relations Committee report. At its peak, the SAVAK had formally recruited 15,000 agents, many of whom also managed informal spy networks, therefore permeating all of society. In the early 1960s, both factions opposing the Shah, the secular left and the conservative clerics, who would have normally opposed each other, started to coalesce and found an inspiring leader in Khomeini, who had by now escalated in ranks and become an Ayatollah. By now more than 60, instead of retiring like many of us would choose to do, this respected religious scholar decided to risk everything to gain center stage in a budding revolutionary movement. Khomeini's outspoken opposition to the government escalated from 1962 to 1963 with a series of speeches and pamphlets which denounced the Shah's latest proposed reforms, which included women's suffrage and the opening of public offices to the non-Shia Baha'i minority. According to a declassified CIA report, these activities were a concerted effort of the Qom mullahs. Khomeini, well, he was kind of a schmuck, a figurehead who had been put in place because the clergy believed they could control him and manipulate his operations. In the early hours of the 5th of June 1963, the Savak came a-knocking in Qom. Khomeini was arrested. It happened during the month of Muharram, a holy period dedicated to mourning according to Islam. The outrage was immediate, resulting in widespread riots with high casualties in the capital city of Tehran and in the town of Shiraz. So, was all of this in the mullah's plans? You see, they wanted to make a puppet out of Khomeini, but they instead had created a martyr and a true revolutionary leader who would not let himself be controlled. In November of 1963, while still under house arrest, Khomeini did something unexpected and certainly not in character with the commonly accepted view of him being a rabidly anti-American leader. He sent a message to the US government using as a conduit Professor Karma Ray from the theology department at Tehran University. Let's quote a piece from the very same CIA report. Khomeini explained that he was not opposed to American interests in Iran. On the contrary, he thought the American presence was necessary as a counterbalance to Soviet and possibly British influence. Khomeini also explained his belief in cooperation between Islam and other world religions, especially Christendom. So now you've got to be wondering, well, what was Washington's response? And I'd like to tell you, but the next paragraph, well, it's been fairly heavily redacted. So would the US government have been open to cooperating with the Ayatollah? Another CIA memorandum issued in November of 1978, sorry to jump ahead so many years there, is doubtful of Khomeini's leadership skills, suggesting that he may not be capable of controlling the revolution that he himself had sparked, with the risk of either a leftist faction or a military dictatorship taking power over the Shah. Combined with the other comments about him being a puppet of the Qom mullahs, it sounds like the CIA and the government in general were seriously underestimating this guy. Whatever opinion the US government had of him, the Ayatollah continued his rise as leader of the opposition. After being released in April of 1964, he resumed his incendiary sermons against the Shah. By now, Pahlavi, he had had enough, and in November, he expelled the Ayatollah, and his exile began. Initially, Khomeini settled in Turkey, from where he continued his vocal attacks on Pahlavi, calling him a pawn of the US and Israel. By 1965, the Turkish, they also had had enough and begged the Shah to take him back, but Khomeini preferred to settle in the city of Najaf, a center of Shia scholarship in Iraq. It was here that Khomeini formulated his doctrine, known as guardianship of the jurist. This concept marks a departure from Shia founding principles. According to this doctrine, when the divinely inspired descendant of the prophet is absent, religious and political leadership of the community can be assumed by the jurist, the expert in Islamic law. This is exactly what Khomeini was, so he was basically saying it's totally okay if I become the leader of Iran. His absence from the country did not prevent him from stoking dissent. The Ayatollah took to recording his own sermons on audio cassettes, which were then smuggled into Iran. And by the way, if you're 20 or younger, an audio cassette was a plastic recording support about the size of a BlackBerry phone that could store up to 2 hours of music or speech on a magnetic tape. By the way, if you're under 20 or younger, a BlackBerry phone was what your parents used to take calls from the office before they came to their senses. And if you're 20 or younger and you're watching a 20-minute video about the Ayatollah Khomeini, well, well done you. Where was I? Ah, yes, the tapes. These tapes found fertile ground, especially amongst the lower classes in the expanding urban centers and amongst university students, regardless whether they were left-leaning or aligned to the religious right. So you might be wondering now, well, what was his agenda? Point A. The Ayatollah opposed the Shah's efforts to give equal rights to women. Point B. He opposed land reforms deemed ineffective in feeding the population. C. He wanted to free Iran from foreign influence, especially that of the US and USSR. D. He protested the inclusion of religious minorities in positions of power, especially the Baha'i. And 5. Finally, Khomeini was a vocal critic of the State of Israel, whom he accused of manipulating the Shah. Over the 1970s, dissent against Pahlavi grew in its intensity. Khomeini kept attacking him from Najaf, and the Shah may have taken his revenge. In 1977, in fact, Khomeini's firstborn son, Mustafa, died in mysterious circumstances. The death was due to a heart attack, but Khomeini claimed that Mustafa had been killed by the government. In the late 1970s, Khomeini enjoyed a high standing amongst both conservative Muslims and the sympathizers of the Tudeh, the local Communist Party. When, on the 7th of January 1978, a state-controlled newspaper questioned the Ayatollah's patriotism and even his sexuality, protesters marched in the streets of Tehran. The police fired on them, and violence escalated. This marked the official beginning of the Iranian Revolution. For the following 13 months, the police, the armed forces, and the SAVAK faced protesters across the country, killing them in the dozens or the hundreds. As customary in Shia Islam, each massacre was celebrated by a mourning period of 40 days followed by demonstrations. Violence would erupt again, and so on. And in 40-day cycles, Iran spiraled into chaos. The Shah, who by now was suffering from late-stage cancer, had little resolve to address the situation. Meanwhile, in Iraq, Khomeini continued to rally the opposition. That is, until Saddam Hussein finally expelled him from Najaf. The Ayatollah, he moved to the outskirts of Paris, and from there he planned his return as a triumphant leader of the revolutionary struggle. And apparently, it was from France that he made his second attempt to seek an alliance, or at least an understanding, with the US. The aim of his messages was to reassure the US that a change in leadership in Iran would not compromise their access to crude oil. In exchange, the Ayatollah asked the US government to use their influence to hold back the army from launching a coup. So did Carter comply? Well, this is not clear. It is true that the military eventually did not oppose the revolution, but this may have been due to simple opportunism. In January 1979, the Shah and his family left Iran officially to take a vacation, but in reality, this was voluntary exile. On the 1st of February, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini returned to Tehran, welcomed as a victorious leader by the crowd. Following a referendum on the 1st of April 1979, Iran officially became an Islamic Republic, and Khomeini became the supreme leader of this theocratic state. It was the end of more than 2,000 years of monarchy in Persia and Iran. So before I continue with the momentous events of the 1980s, let me give you an example of how Khomeini, now in power, applied his doctrine of the guardianship of the jurist. So the new constitution, it declared Shia Islam to be the official religion of Iran, being the faith of 90% of the population. It also acknowledges minority groups as official religions such as Sunni Muslims, Christianity, Zoroastrianism, and even Judaism, which is pretty surprising considering Khomeini's anti-Zionist stance. However, the constitution excluded the Baha'i faith, making it effectively illegitimate. And this is not surprising seeing as how the Shah's pro-Baha'i policy was one of the many reforms that triggered Khomeini into joining the opposition. The Baha'i religion formed as an offshoot of Shia Islam in the mid-19th century, and it was viewed as heretical by many senior mullahs. After the rise of Khomeini as supreme leader, up to 20,000 Baha'i worshippers fled the country to avoid persecution, imprisonment, or even execution. By May 1983, at least 150 Baha'i men and women had been hanged or shot by the revolutionary government. The persecution of the Baha'i is just one example of the repressive nature of this revolutionary regime. First, his regime ousted from positions of power the former secular allies. Then it took political vengeance, with hundreds of people who had worked for the Shah's regime reportedly being executed. The remaining domestic opposition was then suppressed, its members being systematically imprisoned or killed. Iranian women were also required to wear the veil, Western music and alcohol were banned, and the punishments prescribed by Sharia law were reinstated. A new armed force that passed Iran would make sure that all aspects of Sharia law would be strictly enforced. Their power has grown over time, sort of becoming a parallel police, army, and air force with a strict focus on enforcing Sharia law and defending the values of the Islamic revolution. So the question really is, has anything really changed since the times of the Savak? The first years of a revolutionary government are the most delicate ones, but the Islamic Republic has survived two major trials: the US Embassy hostage crisis and the war with Iraq. On the 22nd of October, the former Shah was allowed entrance into the US to be treated for cancer. On the 4th of November, a mob of some 3,000 protesters, mostly university students, stormed the US Embassy in Tehran and took hostage about 63 staff members. And what was Khomeini's involvement in this crisis? Well, very little, actually. The storming was a result of a spontaneous demonstration, so he had no idea that it would take place, and he probably could have done without it. But once he started, well, he sort of got along with it and offered support to the protesters. It was, in fact, during November of 1979 that he first started using in his speeches his now infamous phrase to describe the US. "Americans are the great Satan, the wounded snake." But his government still had to negotiate with Satan. Talks with the Carter administration dragged on for months, with Iran demanding that the Shah's financial assets in the US be returned to the country in exchange for the hostages. The US, in reply, froze all Iranian assets and filed a lawsuit with the International Court of Justice. In April 1980, Carter's administration authorized a military rescue operation, which became a failure before it had even started. 8 Special Forces helicopters had stealthily entered Iran, but when 3 of them malfunctioned, the mission was aborted. Sadly, on the way back, one of these choppers crashed, causing the death of 8 servicemen. The Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, resigned. As for Carter, well, his presidency was doomed. In May, the US and its allies had imposed an embargo on Iran, but the government of Tehran still played hardball in negotiations. What tipped the scale was the second calamity that befell the young republic, the start of the war with Iraq, on the 22nd of September, 1980. Realizing that Iran could not fight Saddam in the chokehold of a trade embargo, Khomeini agreed to release the hostages on the 20th of January, 1981. The new US president, Ronald Reagan, had been inaugurated just 20 minutes earlier. The crisis had been resolved, but it had lasted too long not to sour the already frosty relationship between Iran and the United States. Their interactions, they remain hostile to this very day. For most of the 1980s, the Islamic Republic had to contend with a bloody war against Saddam's regime. The Iran-Iraq War, the longest of the 20th century, dragged on until July 1988, and it combined horrors from both world wars because of its use of trench warfare, poison gas, and bombings on civilian targets. The Iraqis' war aim was to gain control over the Shatt al-Arab, the confluence of the rivers Tigris and the Euphrates, the only access to the sea. They also had in mind to stop the spread of the Shia Islamic Revolution into their Sunni secular state. Khomeini's regime could not field an army as modern and as mechanized as Saddam's, who would enjoy support from the US and most Sunni Arab countries. What they could offer, though, was numbers and fanaticism. Thousands of boy soldiers were indoctrinated by mullahs into launching suicidal human wave attacks armed only with a plastic key, the key that would open the gates to paradise after their death as martyrs of the revolution. But it turns out that human wave attacks do not make strategic progress. Tehran was in dire need of more complex tactics and weapons systems, namely long-range missiles. Khomeini's regime, it would procure them in 1985 in a way which shows how ambitious and confusing the US-Iran relationship was. The resulting mess, it became known as the Iran-Contra affair, something you might have heard of. Iran made the first step with a secret request to Washington to buy up to 1,500 long-range missiles. President Reagan and his national security advisor, Robert McFarlane, saw a chance to kill two birds with one stone. First grasped the occasion to negotiate with Iran for the release of seven Americans taken hostage by Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia fighters loyal to Khomeini. Second, make some cash through the arms sales to fund the Contras' anti-communist insurgents in Nicaragua. Yes, it was pretty complicated. Along the way, Reagan and McFarlane killed another bird called American rule of law. Their actions violated the trade embargo on Iran, violated the presidential promise not to negotiate with terrorists, and violated the recently passed Boland Agreement, which forbade the government from intervening in Nicaragua. Wow. And that is why you've probably heard of the Iran-Contra affair. But let's get back to the war. Even with their new missiles, the Iranians were not able to break the front line. The war ended in July 1988. Its result, well, it was a costly stalemate. Between 500,000 and 1,000,000 people had died. 500,000 soldiers were crippled, and $400 billion of damaged infrastructure was done for almost no gain. Saddam, in the end, got his outlet to the sea, only to return it to Iran in 1991 in exchange for their neutrality during the First Gulf War. But actually, Khomeini and his regime, they'd gained something from the conflict, albeit something immaterial. The total war against an ethnically Arab, Sunni, secular enemy had consolidated the resolve and institutions of the young revolutionary government in a country that was non-Arab, Shia, and theocratic. Only a few months after the end of the war, in February 1989, the Ayatollah Khomeini made headlines again when he issued a fatwa against writer Salman Rushdie, accusing him of tainting the name of the Prophet Muhammad in his novel Satanic Verses. A fatwa is a legal document issued by a mullah, which in this case carried a death sentence against the writer and a monetary reward. Salman Rushdie was forced into hiding and to seek police protection. Khomeini's condemnation of the Satanic Verses, though, it was short-lived. 4 months later, in June of 1989, Ayatollah Khomeini, he died. Regarded as a hero or condemned as the ultimate villain, both outside and within his country. His reputation as a ruthless leader who would not refrain from harming, exiling, or killing opponents to achieve his goal is certainly well-deserved. But isn't that true of so many leaders around the globe? And wasn't that true for Shah Pahlavi himself, or Saddam, or Saudi Arabia? And yet, they did, and still do have, the support of America and the West. Khomeini did open himself up to America on at least two occasions, and he may have been ignored or underestimated. On the other hand, the Iran-Contra affair could have been the occasion to thaw the frost. But it seems like Khomeini's ill-advised decision to back the protesters during the hostage crisis had made his relationship with America impossible to mend. Now, Professor Mahmoud Sariogalem of Tehran University espouses a geopolitical theory according to which America and Iran should not antagonize each other, as Tehran is the natural ally of the US in the region. A foothold in this country would provide access to Central Asia, the Gulf, and its resources. It was the case in the past, and who knows, maybe it will happen again in the future. But at least for the past 40 years, US and Iranian foreign policy seems to have missed the trick.
So I really hope you enjoyed that one. As I said at the beginning, it'd be great if you left us a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. That would be cool. Maybe you're driving right now. Just remember to do that when you get home. That would be really cool of you. If you want to say hi to me on social media, I'm at Simon Whistler. That's just at Simon Whistler, no dot or anything in there, on Twitter and Instagram and, you know, maybe some other places in the future. That depends on when you're listening to this, but it'll always be at Simon Whistler. So go check that out. And as always, I'll see you next time.